Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Unheard. I'm Freddie Sayers. Kate Clancy is a teacher, playwright, multi-prize-winning poet and writer. In 2018, she was awarded an MBE for services to literature and became one of the most celebrated voices here in the UK teaching poetry to young people. Except, over the past year, an online campaign has grown against her, accusing her of everything from racism to ableism, with the result, as of last week, that her books will no longer be published by Picador. She's with me here in the studio to tell us about it. Kate, welcome.
Hi.
Let's just start with a kind of overall introduction. What are you? How long have you been doing it? How do you think of yourself?
I'm a writer and a teacher. And I've been a teacher since I graduated, and I've been a writer since about 1995. And these are my selected poems. My first collection came out in 1996. So that's really a very long time.
So you were a teacher first
and
blossomed into
first.
A poet and,
a
writer.
I used to be a teacher with writing as my hobby. And then I always used to say to my students, a writer with teaching as a kind of as a passion that I was able to do, more for love than money, which was a wonderful privilege. And for more than a decade, I worked in one particular very multicultural school near me, and we wrote lots and lots of poems, and many beautiful and good things came out of that. And in 2018, we published this book, England Poems from a School, which is all by recent migrants. So it's got an amazing list of names there, which remind me of all my beloved students. And they're beautiful poems. And when it first came out, it had it got a wonderful reception. People really loved it. And they've been re-anthologized and used in lots of different places.
Mm-hmm.
And then the year after that, I published a memoir, which I'd actually been working on.
Which I have here.
Yeah, Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me, which I'd been working on for more than 10 years. I'm a slow writer. And it's the story of the different people I've taught. And it employs a kind of vulnerable eye. That is, it has a Kate in it who meets different students, different young people. And quite often at the beginnings of the story, she has some cliched ideas, she has some stereotypes, and it employs kind of sentence by sentence a vulnerable eye, because it's about learning, and I try to make the learning always fall on the Kate character. Mm.
I've just been reading this. Mm. It's a lovely book. It's stories from your long teaching career.
Yeah.
And you've been moving around different schools. There's a school in Scotland, school in London. And your experiences of the different pupils and their different backgrounds and what you learned from them and what they learned from you, in essence.
It is.
And this was the book that began the story that we're now going to hear about.
This is the book that began the story. But so, I think the movement against England Poems from a School and people beginning to see that as an exoticising or patronising book was part of what was going on.
So you feel that the sort of campaign or the atmosphere started to change around that book then, which was the anthology.
Yeah, it started.
And so what was the accusation at that stage, that by focusing on poems from people from immigrant communities, you were in some way exoticizing them or commoditizing them in some way. What was
right,
the accusation?
Yeah, exactly what you said, exoticizing and commodifying, and that their poems weren't really by them, or that they shouldn't be read, or that the young people were being oppressed or used in some way by having their poems published.
I mean, this is what is so strange about this kind of story, and this is such an extreme example of it. Well, that endeavor is so obviously an attempt to kind of reach out to these different communities and celebrate their differences. At least that's what it appears like to me. Do you feel like sort of by trying to be a good person in that direction, you've made yourself more vulnerable to attacks?
I don't think it's untrue. I think it's something that I always talked to the students about, was that people do pat them on the head to feel better. That it's possible that some of the attention that they receive is patronising. It's more than possible, and people do sometimes receive what they say in a flat way. I've had lengthy discussions with they're grown up, a lot of them now. They've grown up. They've got politics degrees. They're award winning writers. They're doing all sorts of things, and in discussion they'll say some of that. That some of their reception was patronising, but overall they gained a great deal. Overall, people want to be published. Overall, they got into all sorts of different rooms. They found themselves on the radio. They found themselves doing different things. And also their words were heard. Mm. For people that maybe didn't hear them completely correctly, I don't think you can legislate how people receive things. Many, many more people were just moved.
So that's the kind of the preface,
that's part of
as
the
it were.
That's the atmosphere beforehand, yes.
Right. So this is a teacher, a poet, an English teacher, encouraging their pupils to write, and then managing to get them published in an anthology is already potentially a transgression of some kind.
I think so, yes. I think it was upsetting people. Again, of course, it's imperfect. It's imperfect, like the anthology is imperfect. It's imperfect, like every day I go into school and encounter different kids. I'm imperfect.
I mean,
that's the way it is.
If you don't mind me saying, it sounds to me like you're being very understanding here. And already, we haven't even got to the main part of the story, but there's a lot of attempt to legitimize some of these criticisms. I mean, I think a lot of common sense people would think that if you've managed to get published a group of poems from your pupils, that's pretty much an unambiguous positive.
I hope so. We just try to think about it all the different ways, and I was always on the other side of this fight. Because for years I was extremely irritated by the way that people didn't receive my students' poems, and I was a great writer of rude letters to young people's poetry competitions, saying, "I truly do not see what the difference between this poem you've chosen and my students' poem is," because there genuinely was prejudice against their landscape, their language that they were using, because so many of the students were of colour and they came from different places. Mm. And I wrote so many of those letters and I campaigned so seriously on that issue. I do find that strange that everything flipped so quickly from being something that I couldn't get people to listen to something which people were said was being listened to in the wrong way because of my prejudice. That seemed to be quite a quick flip.
And
then move on to this, yes.
Let's talk about this one, because this is where things really got out of hand.
Yes.
So this is a memoir.
Yeah.
As we said, it's a collection of examples of different pupils from over the decades, from all sorts of different places. And it strikes me as a book absolutely full of love and enthusiasm for those experiences. Mm. Every page you can tell that you are deeply invested in these people and fascinated by them and positive about them. What was the complaint about this book?
The complaint was that I'm racist and ableist.
What were the
and
examples?
Cruel.
So give us your head.
So the famous examples were, there's a story about teaching in Essex in the 1990s, and one of the problems I had then was that I knew that the students in front of me came from the East End of London. Their names told me that they came from all sorts of different origins, and I couldn't get them to talk about where they came from. I knew some of them came from you know, Wales, some of them came really a very short generation from pogrom. And I was so interested in those issues.
This is a Jewish, you know,
yeah, pogrom. Absolutely. We were teaching Oliver Twist. And I wanted them to talk about their heritage, but I couldn't get them to. And I took them down Brick Lane, it was an area of closure that I had difficulty with. I wanted more positive identification from them. And at one point, I said, a boy has an Ashkenazi nose, and that has been taken as racial profiling. I would truly apologise if someone is offended by that. It's not what I meant. What I meant was, you lovely kid. Why don't you love your amazing heritage I think is fantastic?
Right, so the quote is, I was baffled when a boy with jet black hair and eyes and a fine Ashkenazi nose named David Marks refused any Jewish heritage. So this is in a list of examples of people who you knew had backgrounds from all over the place but somehow weren't engaging with it.
Yeah, and many Irish kids clearly of Irish heritage. I'm of Irish heritage. It's such an important thing to come from a potato famine, to come across. And you know, there's so much beauty in poetry and song that goes with that, and asking them to why didn't they want to identify with that? And the book goes into quite a lot of talk about that, about, you know, and there is pain and difficulty that's caused that change, that people, they don't want to claim that because it's associated with poverty and huge amounts of difficulty. And that's what the book goes on to say.
I guess there are two sort of strands to this. One is the kind of idea of observing someone's physical appearance and how it relates to where they've come from or their background, which is, I suppose, is now taboo. You know, it would appear from this experience you've had. I mean, you talk about handsome Kenyan face or stiff Japanese hair. These are things used affectionately about different pupils that you had, that you're recalling and as differences. But it sort of feels politically incorrect, or it feels taboo to describe anything physical connected to where someone comes from. Is that where we now are?
It is. It seems to be. I would say in schools, in teenage years, if you remember your teenage years, there's nothing that children worry about more. And schools are very physical places. Kids look different, and how they present themselves is hugely important. And if you're in a very multicultural school, especially, I mean, English multiculturalism is different from American multiculturalism. We've got huge, especially in the last 20 years in the south of England, quite amazing numbers of very recent migrants from Europe and from, you know, from every continent of the globe presenting. And just as with their appearance and with their nationality, they want two things. I mean, they want to fit in and be accepted, but they also want their difference to be acknowledged. And every encounter is a dance between those things, as it is between every human being. And also there is a dance of perception. So you perceive people as different, and you want to, and you accept them, but their difference wants to remain from you. That's being a human being. And I tried in this book to take you through some of those journeys as a teacher that you see. You know, so I learned, for example, that I was thinking of two boys as the same, as similar, as looking similar, but they educated me that actually the fact that one of them didn't look Somali enough for him was the biggest trauma of his life. He wasn't worried about acne or, you know, whether he looked attractive. He was actually worried that his appearance might menace his family's visa status, which is not something that I'd ever thought of. But I thought that it was a story that was worth recounting so that other people could share that experience and imagine that pain, because it's part of a whole chapter about the lies that we oblige people to tell when they come into this country because of our laws, because of what's happening and how that impacts on young people and their capacity to tell stories. So it's a story within a story within a story. It's not a story of racial prejudice. It's a story about difference. But maybe you're right. Maybe we can't write about difference anymore. And that would be sad.
That's what struck me having just finished the book, is that you're not afraid to talk about both culture and physical appearance of these students who you obviously loved a great deal. That people, you know, can believe what they like about how we should describe people physically. But is it also true now, do you think, that you can't describe people's cultures, or it's in some way stereotyping or generalizing to make any comment about people's culture. So you have, for example, Kurdish pride, you know, a particularly proud, vigorous Kurdish lady who was getting you to do things for her. What should the rule be about that, apparently?
Well, I mean, it is something that I considered very carefully, because I think it's very important. And that's why this book doesn't have descriptions of people as they are. It only has descriptions of people as they appear to me. So in each scene, and that's why people, you know, I know that Kate in the book is grating, and why her middle classness is extremely made obvious, because I think you can't describe people, as it were, from a neutral point of view, and certainly not from inside them. But what you can do is have an almost an irritating narrator, a raised narrator, and we know who she is. And so you know in each scene that here's Kate, and she's full of these middle class notions, and she's panicking, and she's worrying about her lesson plan, and then she's taking in the other person, the child she's talking to, from that point of view. And it's all done very, very carefully in that way. So that I never say, this is what this person is. I always say, this is how I perceive this person, and these are my perceptions. And you know who's doing the perceiving. But I don't think, maybe that's not good enough. I don't know.
But even that...
It's not good enough if you don't read the end of the paragraph.
I wonder, because people have always talked about differences in cultures, and obviously there are differences in cultures.
There are differences, and they're very interesting.
It would be fantasy to pretend that there aren't. And actually, what this book seems like to me is almost a kind of, it's a vision of multiculturalism that could be a beautiful thing. It's the most positive version of multiculturalism that we could hope for, where cultures are, as you say, both identified as having different angles, but also having common ground.
Well, that's what a multicultural classroom can be. That's why I love teaching there, you know, and that's why this amazing book, this poetry, can come out of them. It's a complete privilege. I think it's one of the best places I've ever been. And I tried to say so.
So actually, if we're not allowed to observe the differences between cultures, what are we left with? It's not a multicultural society, it's a monocultural society. Or what's the effect of being forbidden to describe and celebrate differences in culture?
It's deadening, I suppose. It's completely different from the real world. And, you know, this argument on Twitter won't stop young people relating to each other and remaking English and relating, you know, changing the world. It's got nothing to do with that, really.
So let's go through the actual sort of timeline with what happened with this book. When it was first published, it was celebrated. It won the Orwell Prize, one of the most prestigious prizes we have in this country. It was reviewed across all of the media extremely positively, and it was a hit. It was then sometime after that this online furore began, as people began to look into it, and certain critics were trying to identify this racist or inappropriate angle. Talk us through what happened.
I was not behaving well, and I wasn't well. Both my parents died in quite difficult circumstances earlier in the year, and I was having difficulties. I was very worried. I've always been worried about the kids that I kind of represent and have to take care of. And they began to be reviews on Goodreads, and they have been changed since, which misquoted and quoted and said I was a racist, began to say those things. And I responded, which I shouldn't have done, and I do apologise, and I have apologised.
So you think you inflamed it?
I did, absolutely. It was absolutely my fault, and I really wouldn't want that to impact on anybody. But then it really went very huge, and lots of, it was the three lines, really. Ashkenazi nose, chocolate skin. They were misquoted. People constantly said Jewish nose, which is not something I ever wrote. context was never there. But it went over and around.
So it started in the review section of Goodreads, which is a website, and then escalated into the
into Twitter, and then almost immediately on Twitter, it went into the academic essay was circulating for some time before that, and the phrases from that were echoed in the Goodreads reviews, and then this was, and clearly I think some people had been expecting, wanting this to happen, and it happened.
And there were certain writers or critics who were kind of leading the charge, both in social media and...
Yeah, but I think anyone caught up in this is caught up in something with its own momentum, and it's terribly, terribly upsetting for them. And I don't blame them. I think they felt very upset and became caught up in something that none of us are very much in charge of.
There's the book, it's a hit. There's the subsequent controversy.
Controversy.
What happens next? Your students actually got involved themselves.
My students were upset. It's very upsetting to have, you know, disgrace poured on something that you've been deeply involved in, of course. But what happened next was my publishers apologised for over my head. One of the problems is that my editors had changed, so I didn't have an editor there. But there was a very senior meeting at Pan Macmillan without anyone who'd read the book in the room, I believe. And they apologised.
Who apologised?
Pan Macmillan apologised over my head.
The MD?
The corporation apologised. They issued an apology. And
for what exactly?
This is a very wide apology, which included online furores and online abuse. And I have no... I couldn't abuse, organise international racist abuse on the internet. I couldn't do that. I have no... I mean, I have nothing to do with that. So they apologised, and they apologised for my racism. And they forgot that I was a live human being in charge of other live human beings. They forgot that I was a teacher. They forgot I was a human being altogether. I've never been so shocked in my life when I heard that apology go out. It went over my agent's head, my head, my editor's head. Anyone who'd read the book was put out of the room.
So they were essentially pleading guilty on your behalf without consulting you.
Yes. And nobody spoke to me. None of them spoke to me. I wasn't spoken to directly. It just went out. And then that night, I obviously wasn't sleeping, and I looked at my email late at night, and there was a reply from somebody I knew to a letter which had been sent out by an editor at Pan Macmillan saying, and she was, it was an angry reply saying, you know, Kate's a human being. What do you mean dumping her like this? And I assumed that the thing that I'd been told could happen, which is that all my books would be pulped, had happened, and this had been announced to all the fellow authors, and with everything else that was going on. Then I decided to kill myself in a way that I have never, ever, ever experienced before. I really genuinely, because I'm a pretty resilient person, as writers go. I'm pretty resilient and sober citizen, and, you know, I'm a teacher. I've got a teacher's pension, all of that. But I was astonished by the strength of that idea. And I have children. I didn't do that. But I know...
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends.
For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Did that, I thought, well, this is something that, you know, all of us here are caught up in something that could have that effect, something very bad.
So the strength of feeling of suddenly having your life's work upturned and being made into something that you should be ashamed of. Actually,
people were caricaturing every single thing I'd done. There wasn't anything I could do about it. They were saying that some of the most that I was some of the things that I most fundamentally hate, and that I've worked for all my life. All my life, I've worked to help young people express themselves. It's what I absolutely most want to do. And to be told that I've been doing that as a kind of secret racism project. There were all the worst things that I could possibly imagine, to have my words disordered and turned upside down, and have my books thrown away.
How long did that kind of suicidal or strength of feeling last? How long has it been?
I can't really remember. I had my cousin came to stay. That's always happens in my life. One of my cousins comes to stay when things are really bad. But I remember noting it, and I tried to tell people about it. I thought, this is the thing that I have to tell people. We've got to not do this. This is not right.
Do you feel that the sort of human aspect just gets forgotten?
I think people just completely forget, because it's like a play. It's like a character play laid out on Twitter. People entirely forget that it's an actual person. So, for example, I mean, after this interview, people will say she's going for sympathy points, or she's trying for the cancelled points, or things like that. But they don't really. If you just use a little empathy, you might think, well, if you're doing a literary critique of this, and someone was authoring it, you might say the author at this point is trying to get a bit of sympathy for the character. But if it's actually happening to you, it's your actual life's work. This is my actual life's work. This is my actual everything that I've always worked for. It has actually been taken away. It really does happen. And when people are mocking your real bereavement, for example, I think people forget that when they write a tweet, it's exactly the same size as a message from a friend. It comes on exactly the same conveyance, and if somebody is mocking something deeply fundamental like a death, that hurts you as fundamentally as if it happened to a friend. So yeah, I think it's very strong, deeply nightmarish, and I felt that is something that we had to write about and try and do better.
Where do you think the cruelty comes from?
Is it in all of us?
And what's so confusing about this, if we're, you know, it strikes me you're being very generous to your critics, but if we try to do that, the confusion is that it comes from a good instinct, or in theory a good instinct, which is a kind of prosecution
of badness, perceived
absolutely. Bias, protection of vulnerable groups and all of that, and yet the ultimate effect of it is so vicious.
Yeah, it comes from inside people. I think it makes people frightened. I think it's deeply frightening for the people who are doing it. I'm absolutely sure it is. And must be horrible for them, because once they've uttered something, made fun of somebody's bereavement, they put themselves up, you know, they've climbed too high a tree. They've done something quite, you know, they've broken taboos. They've done something quite terrible, really. And then, so then it has to be the right thing. And
you feel they have to double down. Have to sort of,
yeah,
tie yourself to the mast once you begin a.
Yeah, you have to. They are tied to the mast. Those words have tied them to the mast, and so therefore they have to keep justifying them. So it's got its own energy, and I think there's a particular thing with me that they just, you know, I was made a symbol of everything that's wrong in British publishing. Because the book was successful, that these slips were seen as being everything that's wrong in British publishing. And that's actually quite a wide thing to carry. And I don't think that my book carries it. It's not a good candidate for that job. And because of that, you know, the whole thing is essentially unstable. And that's why it keeps going. It's like nuclear fission. So because the book can't really carry the charges that are laid against it, the people that are making the charges are always risks looking like they're bad people, so they have to double down and double down and double down. So it has an endless energy to it.
So at one point it was announced that you were going to rewrite sections of the book. Was this subsequent to that?
And yes, that was subsequent.
Did you agree to do that?
Well, yes, because I enjoy an editing process, and I think that editing is good. And I was looking forward to, you know, that I'm always happy to do that.
Book then that at that point is 2 years old and has won the Orwell Prize and has been given 5-star reviews across the media. Why would 2 years later you want to rewrite sections of it?
Well, partly because one of the truly malign things that happened, dangerous malign things that's happening and is still happening, is that people started to play around with trying to find the identification of the children. Now, Some Kids I Taught is written exactly like every other, well, there's 3 teaching memoirs out this year which are written on exactly the same principle. All medical memoirs are written like this. Most memoir is written like this, which is that you have consent for some people, there are some people that know that you're in there, and there are other people who are very, very heavily disguised. And I think that Some Kids has been tested more than any other one I can think of, in that there are people out there doing things like pretending to have been at school with the students and pretending that they knew secret knowledge about which students they were. A truly malign activity, truly cruel, desperately upsetting for the students.
And frightening for you as well, yes. Because there's this sense they might be sort of uncovered or not.
Well, because you might make a false identification. You can make identifications across from this book, for example, or you can make identifications across from Twitter. You can make a false identification. You could deeply upset somebody by saying this is you when it absolutely wasn't. So, and my publishers did not stand up for me at that point, and they did not stand up for the children. They agreed with, they made a donation to charity in response to a baseless letter which said that there had been irregularities in my teaching practice. There are no irregularities in my teaching practice. Nobody has complained. And my students, and that's what one of my students, when I was discussing with my students if we should continue to be published with them, my students said, no, you should leave because they left us to defend you. And we were happy to defend you, but it was not our job.
Let's hear about that. So your students took it upon themselves to write a letter.
Yes.
Together.
Yes.
Saying, no, you were a good teacher. And I've got a quote from it here. They said, though well-meaning people appear to want to defend us, in some ways their intervention is often disempowering and causing us distress because it does not reflect our reality. We do not need defending. We will speak for ourselves. So they obviously felt that what was happening to you and by implication them was unfair.
Yeah, and very upsetting.
And very upsetting.
Yeah, they're not zombies.
So even despite that, this is what's...
This is still going on. People are still tweeting that they're too young to understand racism. These are 25-year-olds.
Right.
That they're too stupid. But, you know, these are political graduates, that they don't understand what's going on, that they're people I barely know. They're not any of those things. They are the people who are in the book, and they've identified themselves they identify themselves very carefully and properly to the bookseller, and they ask the bookseller not to put their names out because, you know, they didn't want to be persecuted.
And the perhaps most famous example is the girl who you described as having arm-shaped eyes. Which was one of the things that was seized upon as being a racist stereotype. She wrote an essay in the Sunday Times saying, "Critics labelled this description patronising, insulting, offensive, colonialist and racist. This upset me. I am that girl with the almond eyes. I did not find it offensive." So we're at the point now where the people to whom the offence was supposedly caused are saying they're not offended by it. And yet another group of people are trying
offended
to insist.
Offended on their behalf. Yeah.
So it's become quite a complicated
It's a very complicated thing. I think, you know, publishing, I made the agreement with some kids on the normal. It was read by a lawyer. It was read by the people in it. And in any normal memoir, it is conforms to the law of the land. And more than that, it conforms to my conscience in that I know that the students in it are being represented properly. But to give you an example there, there's somebody on the internet trying to out the character called Akash, who's a young, in the book, is a young Nepalese boy who is very brilliant and gay, and he's wondering about coming out to his family. Akash, of course, is grown up. I had to phone him up. He's living abroad at the moment. He's his own writer, an editor. He's doing tremendously well. And say, somebody's trying to do this. Someone's trying to out teenage you on the grounds that it's a data breach. And his response was, first of all, I am a literary figure in the book. That is not me. That's a literary figure. Second of all, I love that portrayal of me. And if I wasn't in the book, I and my gayness would not be able to talk to other queer boys across time. And then finally, this is deeply offensive. I am deeply hurt, because he does not want malign people with malign intent, you know, making malign accusations that his data has been breached, as if he couldn't consent, as if people couldn't listen to him. And yet this is still going on. People are still doing that in order to demonstrate that I'm an evil person. It's really very bad for the kids.
I mean, what I think, if you're so much at the centre of this storm, I think for people who didn't know about it before, it will strike them as wild that a teacher and writer who is producing a poetry anthology or writing a memoir with highly affectionate portrayals of your former pupils finds yourself in a sort of doxing, identity revealing witch hunt where you need to try and protect the pupils, and there are people trying to out them for no reason at all. It's the disconnect is so huge.
It's very upsetting.
Do you feel like you're able to keep it in perspective in that sense, or do you feel like you're able to understand that for most people it would seem totally baffling?
It baffles and amazes me. But that's why I decided that I had to leave.
So let's get to that point. So you've had these students defending you. You've had various people both attacking and defending you.
Things settled down a bit for a while.
Things settled down for a bit, and then a senior executive at your publisher reawakened the controversy in some way by initially defending you or saying that he wished he had defended you more, and then retracting that.
What
happened then?
Well, there were two things happening at the same time. So I'd written a piece for Prospect about the thing I was telling you about ostracism and suicidal ideation. And I wrote that because I genuinely feel it's something important that people should understand. And then that was coming out at the same time. Everything was going quite peacefully. The executive at Pam Macmillan said I should have had more rights.
The chief executive.
Yeah, and well, he's an editor.
Yeah.
And then withdrew it, and then I was put under pressure not to write in Prospect, to withdraw the piece in Prospect.
How did they put you under pressure?
They asked me to withdraw it again, and always in the background is the idea that my books will be removed. I mean, that's been there from the beginning, that all my books could be cancelled.
When you say in the background, has that ever been mentioned as a threat? Well,
yes. And
so your publisher is asking you not to write a piece for Prospect, a
because,
magazine?
Because it would associate, I don't know, because I shouldn't write about my experience. But
with the implicit or explicit threat that they'll pull you as an author and cancel your
work. Well, that's always there, yeah. And then I wrote the piece. I didn't cancel the piece, and the piece went ahead, and people reacted with, I was trying not to write just about myself. I was trying to write about the process. But, you know, people did react with wishing me dead a great deal. And then my publishers apologized to my critics and distanced themselves from my piece.
Your publisher, you write a piece about feeling suicidal during this incredibly traumatic.
Yeah, well, I tried to write about my feelings, but I also tried to write it as wider, you know, this is something that can happen to people and perhaps we can take better care, was what I was trying to say.
But your publisher's response is to wash their hands of you and apologise for your piece.
Yeah. I want to be able to write. It's very hard to write after one of these things because it comes at a very micro level, so you can imagine jeering happening just after one or two words. It's quite hard to write.
So who are these people and how can they behave in such a callous way?
Well, I think they weren't people that knew me very well because my own editor had just left. And I think they were in a new situation and they didn't know what to do. I think the president or the CEO is moving on as well, so it was, you know, a slightly awkward time. So I think that's what happened.
But, you know, that's again being generous. You know, what about just saying that it's totally unacceptable?
I think it's damaging. I think anyone who's writing a memoir should be very concerned because what they said in the end was that they're responsible for offence on the internet. And I don't think publishing can be responsible for offence on the internet because I think you've got to be responsible for the betrayals of the young people. And I hope I am in that nobody has complained. That's the test of a memoir. Every so often you get, you know, a memoir and somebody complains and says, hey, that's me playing tennis. And then people have to pay out or change the text or do whatever they do. That's how memoirs have been published for 100 years. My book's absolutely fine with all of those things. Nobody's recognised themselves. Nobody has complained. No one's in it. But Picador's doing something completely new. Pound Macmillan was doing something completely new when they said, we are responsible for associations that people bring for this book. We are responsible for people having arguments on the internet late at night in association with this book. And I think that's an infinite area of offence. Mm. And if that's seriously where publishing is going to go, then it's going to make a lot of difficulties for writers and publishers. I don't know what you can write or publish.
So here you've got a famous imprint, Picador, of Pam Macmillan, one of the big publishing houses. And normally it's often said that it's the slightly more junior people within these organisations who are lobbying for these kind of movements. But it sounds from what you're saying that it went all the way to the top.
Yes. Well, because I was excluded and everybody I knew was excluded from those meetings, I don't really know. But I believe that the children's division was important. That's just what I've been told. I just don't know.
So what does that mean for book publishing? I mean, you're not the only example. This is maybe a particularly egregious and nasty example, but the same kind of hesitancy and angst is across all sorts of cultural areas,
absolutely.
And publishing in particular. What's the way out of it?
I don't know. I mean, it's not about writing, I can tell you that, because nobody had read the book. So it was about me as a Twitter person. I suppose it means that publishing is entirely about social media and popular people will be published and unpopular people won't be. And people's reputations will rise and fall entirely on that. So that's a different world. I suppose it's the morality is strange. Because I kind of relied on publishing to be basically, I mean, publishing is basically ourselves, isn't it? It's just a reflection of where we are right now, and that's what it has to be. And it is there to make money. I think it's not the BBC, it's not a National View. But I think the idea that publishing, and it is a popular idea, that publishing is there to be very virtuous and convert people, and I think that's the idea now. I don't think that can really fly. I think publishing can only defend its own. It can only defend breadth of expression. It can only defend nuanced expression. The laws are there for us. Mm. I think it has to go back to that. I don't see how this model is going to do anything other than really damage people, because everybody is damaged. The people that issue those edicts and those statements, I'm sure, are very upset and damaged. I'm sure that's not their best day by a very long way. The people that are stuck on social media, endlessly doubling down on me, they're having a terrible time. I've had a truly terrible time and lost everything I most value. I don't know who has benefited. The young people who had a wonderful time with publication, you know, the people who had this, the young people in this book had a wonderful time. The goldenness of publication, all the clever things that publication can do, It made them grow, it made them happy, changed their lives in really positive ways.
So they've now been depublished.
They've been depublished. And they've been associated with heartbreak and disgrace. And that's the worst bit for me.
So what happens next, Kate? Will you seek out a new publisher? Will you continue writing? What's the next
step? Well, I'm writing things again.
Great.
Quietly in a room. I write my best things with no expectation of them people reading them. And I'm very lucky to still have teaching work, because people know me, and I am good at teaching, and they know me, and I always turn up, so I still have my job. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
I've got enough to be going on with. So that's my plan, is to do my teaching and to carry on writing. And I hope to be able, you know, people are going to ask me about this, and I hope to be able to comment and to, you know, what I tried to do in Prospect was to comment in a humane way.
Mm.
Not in a not too divisive way, because it's, you know, when all this was going on in the summer, at the same time, one of my students was stuck in Afghanistan, and I and several of my other students were writing lots and lots of letters to the Home Office, none of which, of course, were read, but, you know, and sending money and all of that kind of stuff to try and get her back. And you can, if you want, there are real things in the world. If you want to write angry letters, you can go to your local asylum centre and help, because there's endless numbers of angry letters to be written to the Home Office. I just hope that that this terrible thing that seems to have happened to really good people, to the liberal left, to everybody I've always thought I was, that's the division between this kind of shadow play Twitter world and the real life. I hope we can heal that division and people can think about what their real values are and go back to making imperfect relationships. I mean, I have no doubt that all my relationships with my students are imperfect. My book is a record of it. But their relationships, we're all humans.
Kate Clancy, thank you so much. You have been listening to Kate Clancy telling us how, within the space of a year, she went from award-winning writer, poet, teacher, to cancelled person, hung out to dry by her publisher, Picador. We're living in very strange times when the person you've just met is considered a menace to society. Thank you very much to Kate for talking to us and to you for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.